KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. This hour, the evolving marijuana industry in California. Last year, the state raked in $600 million in tax revenue from cannabis sales, but years after voters legalized recreational pot, the marijuana industry still faces major hurdles, including increasing tax rates, which are driving pot sales underground. Meanwhile, new guidance from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration finds that cannabis-derived CBD can harm users. Coming up on Forum, we'll examine the outlook for the cannabis industry in California and hear what consumers can expect in 2020. We'll get started right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer in today for Michael Krasny. Well, on January 1st, the state taxes are going up for the cannabis businesses in California, and it's shaking an industry that's already struggling with the high costs of regulation, not to mention competition from a thriving underground market. And so this hour on Forum, nearly 2 years after the legal sale of recreational marijuana began, we're taking a look at the latest cannabis news, including those increased taxes, along with legal battles between the state and counties that have banned cannabis deliveries, and recent FDA warnings to CBD businesses over health concerns, false advertising, that kind of stuff. And in a moment, we're going to bring in David Downs. He's the California Bureau Chief for Leafly.com. But let's begin with the tax man. Nicholas Maduros is director of the California Department of Tax and Fee Administration. Nick Maduros, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin with those taxes. Which tax exactly is going up and by how much?
Well, so there are two specific cannabis taxes in the state of California. There's an excise tax and a cultivation tax. The cultivation tax, we are required by law to adjust January 1st to account for inflation since legal adult use cannabis began in January of 2018. So those cultivation taxes will go up just by the California Consumer Price Index rate of inflation, which is a bit over 4%. Most of the discussion, however, has been around the excise tax, and that's a 15% tax on the retail selling price of cannabis. And we aren't adjusting that 15% tax. That's set by Prop 64, which the voters passed in 2016. What's happening, and it's sort of convoluted, so bear with me. I know math doesn't make the best radio, but
it's true.
There's this 15% tax. Ideally, if a consumer went in and spent $20, there'd be a $3 excise tax on cannabis. But when the legislature implemented Prop 64 back in 2017, they kept that 15% tax on the retail selling price, but they made the cannabis distributor, who's essentially the wholesaler, responsible for remitting the tax to the state. But that wholesaler only knows the wholesale price. So what the law requires us to do every 6 months is look at what the average markup is between the wholesale price and the retail price in the state of California for cannabis products. That has been set at 60% for the last almost 2 years now. It will go up to 80%. Now, what that means, that's not an 80% tax, just to be clear. Mm-hmm. What that means is if a distributor sells something to a retailer for $10, the tax is 15% of, it's currently 15% of that $10 plus the 60% markup. So yeah. 15% of $16, it'll go up to be 15% of $18 on that same transaction come January.
And so the excise tax is it paid by customers when they
By the customer.
Yeah, and the cultivation tax is paid by the grower. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, and so how do you collect the tax? I mean, because you know banks are not supposed to be in the business of taking money from pot clubs or not clubs but businesses in California or the U.S. Right? How do you get around that?
Well, we do collect most of our cannabis revenue through normal banking channels. A lot of these businesses have found their way into the banking system. But we do have locations around the state where we do accept, under some very heavy security, cash tax receipts.
So there's people who are driving up in like trucks and suitcases full of cash to this secret location? That's a long pause, dude.
Yes. There are people coming in often with their own security as well. We're keeping the armored car industry in California pretty occupied.
All right. Well, I won't ask you for any more details. How much money has California been getting from the sale, the cultivation of marijuana, and how does it square with what you were expecting?
Well, if you look back to January of last year when this began until now, between the excise tax, the cultivation tax, and then the state standard sales and use tax, which also applies to cannabis sales just as it to all other or most other retail sales, we've collected about $845 million so far. That is lower than our projections, maybe by about half.
And what accounts for that?
I think a number of factors, but most clearly there's still a thriving underground market here with people who aren't collecting and remitting the taxes that are due.
And is that so? That's largely to avoid these very taxes, that, and so it's cheaper to go to the black market?
I think that's certainly part of it. I think there are other regulatory issues. There are wide swaths of the state where localities have not allowed any legal cannabis retailers. So it's not just a tax issue, but I'm certain taxes play some role in that.
And you're responsible for these statewide taxes, but there are also local fees and taxes that get placed by counties and cities, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And so I know it varies a great deal by where you are, but in general, how much of the cost of whatever, a joint, is tax? What percentage of what you're paying is going to taxes and fees?
Well, if you look at this example that I gave you with the excise tax, if you were to spend $20, the excise tax would be about $3. You'd have a little bit of that would be cultivation tax, and then you'd have a somewhere around 7-8% sales and use tax. So, it's a substantial portion.
Yeah, it's not insignificant.
Not overwhelming, and frankly, it's actually less as on a percentage basis than the state's tax on cigarettes, for example.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, Nick Medeiros from the California Department of Tax and Fee Administration, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And it'll be a happy new year up in Sacramento. More revenue coming in, I guess. Well, let's bring in David Downs. He's the California Bureau Chief for Leafly.com and author of the Medical Marijuana Guidebook, America's first how-to guide for patients and caregivers. Also former cannabis editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. David, welcome.
Hi, Scott.
First of all, just what you heard there from Nick Medeiros, anything jump out at you?
Yeah, one thing consumers need to know is that the price of cannabis overall is falling, and I always care about my readers and what's going to happen to them in the stores. And what we're hearing from the data from the cash registers, which is being collected by companies, is that the average eighth ounce of pot, that's like a one-finger plastic baggie for you old schoolers out there, that's running about $32 before tax. So $32 an eighth before tax, and somewhere between $32 and $40, depending on who you ask. So, after you get out the door, you're looking at a $35 eighth, $38 eighth, not the end of the world, especially during when you consider prohibition peak prices were like $60 an eighth. And the medium to long game of this is that the price of cannabis is going to keep coming down. And in the end result, most of the price of cannabis is going to be the taxes and fees. We're an industrial agricultural society. We're going to get very good at producing this at large scale. A lot of big farms are opening up, and we expect this $32 an eighth price point for this year to be maybe half that by next year. And when you look at places like Oregon and Colorado, these really mature markets, prices are very low. The taxes are not creating this barrier to entry that a lot of people are worried about.
And so as the price comes down, the revenue from taxes is going to go down. It'll be a larger percentage of each sale. But is that a long-term trend as well then?
That's correct. And so when Nick says, proportionally cigarettes are taxed higher, again, Marlboro's growing cigarette or making tobacco at dirt cheap prices, pennies on the pound. Cannabis used to wholesale for $6,000 a pound, and it's on its way to $150 a pound. You certainly are going to be able to balance city or state budgets on the backs of cannabis, but they can contribute and they cannot take away from tax revenue in terms of criminal justice costs and those kind of things.
So taking a step back and looking at it from 30,000 feet to mix metaphors, what's the state of the industry in California right now?
I say we're in our terrible twos. We have Prop 64 passed in 2016. The first limited legal sale started on January 1st, 2018. We're wrapping up the second year, January 2019. We have about 600 stores open. We saw the first year do about $1.8 billion in gross year one revenue, on its way to $10 billion. But people need to keep time in proportion here. We've had a black market since the 60s. We've had the domestic epicenter for cultivation since the 80s. And so we are 700 days into a new regime in the eighth largest economy of the world. And yeah, it's loud, it's messy, it's very willful, and but there's also a lot of joy in there too.
And temper tantrums from time to time as well.
Constant tantrums every day.
And so California has 58 counties. How many counties have legalized the sale of marijuana?
Less than half, as I recall. I'll have to pull the latest numbers because they're changing every day. New counties and new cities are adding medical dispensaries for the first time, which they've never done since Prop 215 in 1996. And adult use stores are coming in as well. But we still have vast swaths of the state where people are driving more than an hour to get legal access to cannabis, specifically the inland California areas and the rural parts of the country. And this is also where we're having over 140 people sick and three dead from vaping-associated pulmonary injury. They're buying those products in the black market. They can't get to tested products in licensed stores because of their local officials.
So in a big county like, say, Los Angeles, I mean, are most of the stores, the businesses kind of concentrated more mostly in the urban part as opposed to some of the more, outlying areas of LA County?
Yeah. Los Angeles is a global poster child for lackadaisical implementation. The city of LA has 180 stores for 4 million people. And the LA County has no retail regulations whatsoever for a region of 10 million people. And this LA County also has one dead from vaping-associated pulmonary injury. And we think that the city of LA alone might need 2,000 stores. And just for some context here, the state of California has like 16,000 locations licensed to sell retail alcohol. So we're at 600 cannabis stores versus 16,000 alcohol outlets. And so that can give you a sense of the gap in terms of how much consumers aren't being served yet.
Of course, some would say we have too many places to buy liquor.
Yes. Yeah. I think this is where many issues intersect, and the liberal, progressive, nanny state approach to telling people how to live their lives is going to interfere with business development, job creation, these kind of things.
So what's the resistance in a place like Los Angeles, where I'm guessing Prop 64 passed pretty easily? I mean, I can understand in a place like, I don't know, San Bernardino or pick a rural county, Mariposa County. What's the resistance in a place like Los Angeles? Is there political pressure to not have them in certain neighborhoods and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. We're a state of NIMBY thinkers. And LA is very much a prism to look at this issue. Local control is clearly out of control. These progressive pot smokers are being hoisted on their own values, which include taxes and big government and red tape and environmental regulations. And that's exactly what's slowing down this implementation. I try to get my kid into a preschool. It took years to get that preschool open because of the costs and the permitting and zoning. And that's a preschool, let alone like a laundromat or a halfway home. It's hard to open businesses in California. The industry is saying it's taking about $2 million in 2 years to open the doors on a pot shop. And so we're about 2 years into legalization, and we expect more stores to be coming. But legalization, cannabis is normalized now. It's part of the normal course of business in California. And our normal course of business is, frankly, broken. We're missing 5 million homes in the state. We're missing regional and statewide mass transit. And it's because of this local thinking and this not in my backyard approach.
You mentioned, I think you said in LA, there are some places where you're an hour away from a place to buy marijuana. But there are also, of course, these companies that will deliver. Ease, for example, we see the billboards on 101 or 80, I guess it is. And there are some legal issues around that as well. And there are a couple of different lawsuits, one in Santa Cruz County, Unpack that a little bit for us. I believe Santa Cruz County is suing a company in, is it Monterey? I think they're in Salinas because they're not licensed to deliver in Santa Cruz County. Can you just like unravel that a little bit?
Yeah, I think most voters know there's a tension between local control and state authority. And the voters with Prop 64 said deliveries are legal. And the locals have said, well, not on my turf. And so we're having cross lawsuits going right now where the city, the county of Santa Cruz and 24 cities, including like Fresno, what's the few things Fresno and Santa Cruz agree on, is suing the state saying, we don't want these license services on our roads. And the state is saying, no, these are public roads. It's in the law. They're allowed to serve citizens there. And this is the counterattack. AG Becerra has joined with a local provider called East of Eden to sue the city of the county of Santa Cruz and saying they're getting $1,000 a day losses in business because they can't deliver into Santa Cruz. AG Becerra here is supporting the will of the voters who voted for Prop 64, who voted for this sort of access. And the reality is cities want these oligopolies because they can extract regulatory rents from them. And there's a lot of political power in making these licenses a political football. And the reality also is that when you have oligopolies, it's terrible for choice for consumers, and it's terrible for price for consumers, and it's terrible for access for consumers. Who it's good for is the stores that get the local licenses and the politicians whose palms get greased to give it to them.
And so there's a separate lawsuit. I think a group of cities and counties, including Santa Cruz, as you mentioned, are challenging the delivery rules in Fresno County as well. Becerra has weighed in on behalf of the company in Santa Cruz, in the Santa Cruz area. Some think that's because he may get a more favorable judge, I think, in that area as opposed to in the inland part of the state. I mean,
probably. Yeah. I mean, tactically, I think he's probably thinking about the big picture and the jurisdiction where it's going to play out, because this, again, has bigger implications than delivering cannabis. This is about setting local tax, like the power for locals to set tax rates on internet companies, and the tension between someone saying, hey, I'm driving down a publicly taxpayer funded road to bring this to your house. You, local councilman, can't stop me from doing that.
Are there analogies there? Are there other kinds of industries where...
This is the Amazon issue. Santa Cruz or Fresno or whatever would love to soak Amazon for local deliveries, and they can't because of this tension between state and local control.
Talking with David Downs, he's the California Bureau Chief for Leafly.com and author of the Medical Marijuana Guidebook, America's first how-to guide for patients and caregivers. Let's open up the phone lines a little early. This is an hour-long segment, but I'm guessing this is what we call a talker in radio. People want to come in, maybe have some questions or comments. Give us a call. It's 866-733-6786. The number again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or if you prefer the old school way, it's email at forum@kqed.org. We were talking at the top there, David, with Nick Maduros about the underground market, and I think something like 70% of the marijuana sales in California is underground. It's still the black market. That was, you know, when Prop 64 was on the ballot, it was kind of sold as a way to get rid of the underground market. But it sounds like it's really thriving.
It is. But I'm surprised the amount of dent we're making in it, considering we've been doing this for 700 days. So there's a lot of inertia around the underground market. About 4 out of 5 pounds of cannabis that are grown in California leave the state. They're exported to the Midwest and the East. And they've been doing that for a number of decades. They have really old school farms and connections to move that cannabis out. And the illicit market is about 3 to 5 times bigger in-state than the legal market. But again, we're 700 days into this, and we're already taking 10, 20% market share from the illicit market. This is a long game. It's going to take a generation, and it's not going to be a war on growers so much as it is going to be enticing consumers out of the black market and changing their habits with testing and labeling. But then I think we need to consider the timeline. I understand voters who are saying, why isn't it like a light switch? You know, I turned the lights on. Why isn't it all changed? They may not know how slow things move in government or how long it takes for, you know, cultures to change. But then there are also actors out there, disgruntled law enforcement officials or opponents who are acting in bad faith by saying it's been overnight. Why isn't things completely, you know, rosy?
California, of course, was not the first state to legalize recreational use of marijuana. Colorado, Washington, Oregon, I think maybe as well. What have we learned from those states that has helped us implement Prop 64 here? And how is the rollout, so to speak, different in California than it is in some of those other states?
I think some of our biggest learnings from other states involve things like social justice, actually. We did a lot around advancing Prop 47 gains and decriminalizing cannabis, decriminalizing not only possession, but like low-level sales and cultivation. We do not have this school-to-prison pipeline like we had years ago, where we had 100,000 people in California at its peak being arrested for cannabis. Now it might be 5,000. I have to check the latest numbers. We created social equity programs in this state that are becoming more mandatory across the country. That's, you know, we did legalization with an eye toward more of the criminal justice aspects than some of these states that went before us, and other states that are going after us are doing even more on that front.
And in terms of revenue being generated, how it's playing out, culturally, are there any big differences between California and those other states?
All these states continue to have issues with their own illicit market, not so much locally, but feeding a national market. Colorado has neighbors that don't have legalization. Illinois is going to have neighbors like Illinois or Indiana that don't have legalization on January 1st when sales begin there. And so there's local issues with, well, why do we still have grow houses here, or why do we still have marijuana activity? And frankly, that's because we're seeing a growing chorus for a federal approach.
All right, let's go to the phones. Again, the number is 866-733-6786. And Chris in Vallejo, welcome. You're first.
Thank you. I have a tour company. We bring people from San Francisco up to Mendocino to visit the farms, and I'm very connected to the farmers up there, and they are getting really squeezed. You know, the prices are going up, their taxes, you know, prices are going down, their taxes are going up, legal fees, hiring lawyers and all that, and it's still rumored among the farmers that even though there's that much legal weed coming out of Mendocino County, that it's still only about 10% of the grows. It's estimated among the farmers anyway that about 90% is still black market. And it seems really short-sighted to me to raise the taxes 20% on these guys where you know, it's just going to squeeze more out of the market. Whereas if you actually lowered them a little bit, you could fight that and get more people growing legally. And if you could even up the number from 10% to 50%, that's a 400% increase on your tax revenue.
Yeah, David, they're trying to strike a balance here. But some of it is also mandated by Prop 64, right?
That's correct. The 15% excise taxes can't go anywhere. They're in the bill. One thing that can move a lot is the local sales taxes. And we've seen some cities, both progressive and regressive, really soak the cannabis industry 10 or 20 times higher than any other business sector in their town. I think of Oakland, where there's been a huge chorus to raise their local sales tax on cannabis, which I think is at like 15 or 10% down.
Didn't they roll it back?
They were talking about it, and I think they're still working at it. It's like probably the only tax going down in Oakland. But I remember sitting in a meeting with a business Chamber of Commerce person, and someone asked the Oakland Chamber of Commerce, is there any other industry that's taxed like this? They said, no way.
Yeah. All right, Chris, thanks very much for the call. We're going to continue our conversation about the state of the cannabis industry in California with David Downs, and we'd love to hear from you. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786. Again, it's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Stick around. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today. In this hour, we're talking about the state of the cannabis industry as some taxes are about to go up on January 1st. My guest is David Downs. He's the California Bureau Chief for Leafly.com. He's also the author of the Medical Marijuana Guidebook. I almost said cookbook. Guidebook, America's First How-To Guide for Patients and Caregivers. David's also the former cannabis editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. As I said, the number to call is 866-733-6786. And let's go to Daniel in San Francisco. You're next. Welcome.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good. How are you?
Very good. Very nice to be on the phone with you as well, David. So I moved out here from the Boston area a few years ago to start a cannabis business. California was much friendlier at the time towards cannabis small businesses. Massachusetts has been very, very restrictive without a couple million bucks in the bank account. And I think one of the biggest frustrations I've seen with cannabis operators is, you know, there's essentially a fork in the road, and a lot of people decided to go for the regulated, you know, on paper market, and they're doing much worse than their buddies who stayed in the black market. So whenever there's these increases in taxes and other roadblocks without much assistance, I think there's just a really, really big sense of frustration among some of these legacy growers who really spent a lot of time and energy and money and invested in, you know, getting themselves into a space where they could pay taxes and do this for a living. So, you know, I hope that the space becomes a little bit easier to navigate as things move forward. But I certainly know that a lot of the talent from California is now abandoning California for opportunities in other states.
Yeah. David?
Taxes do not equal craft grows, small grows, or diverse grows. Regulations do not equal craft grows, small grows, or diverse grows. We didn't have craft beer in America until we loosened regulations around minimum production amount, and we set those original production amounts because we wanted to have a limited number of producers. If you look at a state like Oklahoma right now, they've had a really light touch, low tax approach to medical marijuana. It's very diverse. Anybody can get in. It's kind of a wild west out there, like stores open on top of stores, and they're going to be growing too much, and the prices are going to crash. It's a real free market, and you get to go experience the joys of the free market and the consequences. We have a more of a mixed approach here in California, very much like any other business. And Massachusetts is the extreme example of almost nearly a command economy. They're picking winners and nearly setting prices. This is America. We have laboratories of democracy. We're all taking different approaches to implementing these policies and achieving the best for the most amount of people. And luckily, you can move to other states or move around. Over the medium to long term, the large, well-capitalized producers and retailers in California are going to benefit from this environment. And we are saying that we are seeing the de facto redlining of all but the 1% out of cannabis simply because of the capital outlays you need to continue going and survive the buffeting of these turbulent times, as well as the licensing fees to get in. And what you're saying very much fits in with our picture. So I hear what you're saying.
Daniel, where are you hearing people going if they're frustrated with California?
There's a lot of people going to emerging markets, less so Oklahoma, more so Detroit right now. I imagine that they're going to have very few barriers to entry simply because they need it so badly. So I'm very, very keen on Detroit. Massachusetts, as you mentioned, is a lot more challenging to get your foot in the door as a small business owner.
Michigan.
But certainly in terms of – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Daniel.
So just in terms of, like, you know, there's a couple forces working against keeping people here in California. If you have a Bay Area salary and you move to Detroit, you're just good to go for a while.
Yeah, Michigan began legal sales on December 1st. Illinois will follow on January 1st. And that trend mirrors what happened with medical marijuana. I remember hearing 5-7 years ago, medical marijuana people going, man, California is saturated. It's too much work. I'm headed to an emerging market. And they said, I'm going to go open a medical dispensary in Michigan. So that very much is what's taking place.
Daniel, thanks very much for the call. To what extent does Prop 64 give – my recollection when it was put on the ballot was that they were going to kind of give a grace period to the smaller growers and kind of keep big tobacco, so to speak, out. How has that worked out, David?
The biggest loophole in Prop 64 that people realize is that there was a cap of like 1 acre per license in Prop 64, but there was nothing to prevent an entity from getting multiple licenses, cultivation licenses. And so in places like Santa Barbara and Humboldt, we've seen companies do what's called stack licenses, and they'll end up with like 400 licenses for that region.
And there's nothing, say, that you know the state can do in terms of our regulation? They'd have to go back to the voters to change that?
No, I believe so. So, yeah, I believe you'd have to look at reopen Prop 64. And another thing is the two largest producers in Santa Barbara and Humboldt are locals who came up from the illicit market and obtained funding and are producing really great product at lower than ever prices. And people sort of love them. So, again, I look at how the readers and the consumers are viewing this and experiencing this, and they're very happy with Honeydew Farms in Humboldt and Raw Garden in Santa Barbara.
Got some listener comments here. Lee writes, I'm a 60-year-old Californian. In 1975, I became a daily user. It was always mom and pop, of course. Now that California is greedy, I know so many like myself on principle will stay in the black market, don't reward the greedy. I guess sort of the, I don't want to say old hippies, you know, are going to stick with what they know, right?
Yeah, and it's a great time to be an old hippie sticking with what you know. You can grow six plants.
Sorry, Lee, I didn't mean to call you an old
hippie. No, yeah, you can grow six plants in your garage. If you're in Sebastopol, you can grow it in your backyard.
Yeah.
And it's harvest season, so people right now are trading their home crop with their friends coming by and having a wonderful time. For them, cannabis is virtually free. You can grow a six-year supply for a couple hundred bucks on your property and be good for a while, and we're certainly seeing that. The other thing about the illicit market is it's just to become less appetizing. I got tired of driving to my guy in the Outer Sunset like 10 years ago and just started going to a dispensary. Nowadays, these products are tested, the labels are accurate, and the stakes have never been higher with what's happening in the illicit market because prices are going down there, people are cutting corners down there, and that's how we ended up with this vaping problem this year.
All right, let's go back to the phones, and Kimberly in Berkeley. Hi.
Hi. So I called in because I was actually in the cannabis space working as a high-level executive for about 8 months, and I was making great money, and I decided it was time to start looking to buy a house. And I called various mortgage companies, and they basically said, you're out of luck. And there's no way that you're going to get any sort of mortgage because it's not a federally regulated industry. So I'm wondering, what's being done right now on the larger conversation of these cannabis executives and these cannabis people that have a ton of money that are looking to buy homes that can't get mortgages?
Cash, paying cash. I have a friend, no, seriously, yeah. I have a friend in Denver who said people are coming in from the industry buying homes with cash is driving the price of homes up.
Yeah, I think of Cindy Copo Banco. She made this brand called Lord Jones, which is like a topical CBD brand out of L.A., sold it to a multinational cosmetics company for $400 million, and bought a Frank Lloyd Wright house in L.A. like last week. What you're speaking to is very true. The capital markets are all messed up because of cannabis's designation as a Schedule I drug under Federal Controlled Substances Act. We're seeing a lot of movement at the federal level to try to allow for cannabis banking, either on its own or as part of a bigger descheduling legalization effort. But until that happens, it creates all these downstream consequences. Small businesses can't walk into a bank and get a bridge loan, so they get knocked out. An executive who's doing well can't walk into a bank and get a home loan. There's tons of consequences from the stigma.
And is that because they can't sort of trust the source of the income? Or like, what is the actual reason?
Yeah. I'm sure you could find a bank to give you – you're not going to get a rocket mortgage on a cannabis job. But, you know, you can – it's usually if you want banking services and access to capital and cannabis, you can expect to pay more and have it take longer and to pay a higher interest rate.
But
and
Kimberly,
it's not
what,
as easy.
What did the bank tell you, Kimberly, exactly? That they couldn't take your money or that they, because you worked in the industry, they didn't sort of, recognize it as a source of income? What was the problem?
Yeah, they said that they wouldn't recognize it as a source of income and they would have to see if my spouse on his job could qualify just in his own income for our home. And I said, but I have, $150,000 in the bank. And they said, that's too bad. We can't use any of that money. We can't touch it. We won't touch it. And I called various mortgage brokers. I called Bank of America. I called, 30 different companies to see if we could figure something out. And they said, well, maybe through a credit union, but you're going to have to put a ton of money down.
Yep. That's what I'm hearing.
They left me. So I quit my job, and I'm back into what I was in before, which is really unfortunate. But, you got to buy a house before the prices are just insane here in this area.
Yeah,
you can't get car loans sometimes if you're in the industry. And if you're a risk and compliance expert in a bank and you're told that you have an individual who wants to take out a loan and their main source of income comes from activity that's related to a federally illegal Schedule I controlled substance, your job as a lawyer at that bank is to be like, don't do that. But, there's a lot of credit unions and smaller institutions. You know, where there's a will, there's a way. And that's how capital is getting into cannabis or cannabis people are getting capitalized.
All right. Kimberly, thanks for the call. Good luck. Is there any move afoot, David? I guess it would have to be federally to ease some of those limitations and burdens, hurdles for people who work in the industry.
Yeah, most importantly is the States Act. That one has a lot of support. It is being eclipsed by the MORE Act, which also has just passed out of committee. It was the first time a House committee ever put legalization to the floor of the House, and that'll be coming up for a vote. But the STATES Act in particular would say that banks who are banking cannabis people and businesses in states where it's legal wouldn't be violating the Controlled Substances Act. That would unlock small business loans, home loans, car loans, that kind of thing.
All right, here's a comment from Aurelio, who says, can your guest speak about diversity and the lack of diversity within the cannabis industry?
We are seeing a diversity problem that's stemming, again, related to capital. We have a lot of legacy act operators who were diverse, who were small, especially in Oakland and San Francisco, who were making edibles in their kitchen and selling them into stores. You need to be in a $1 million kitchen now, and you need to have a lobbyist to get a license from the planning department. So if you don't have that skill set and that money, then you're out of the game.
Didn't Oakland also, or I mean, I don't know if it actually passed, but I know they were discussing, like, basically helping so-called victims of the war on drugs to get into the industry as kind of reparations in a way.
Yeah, I sort of see this as them trying to drill a porthole through the red tape for people that are they deem as like selectively special parties. So Oakland's got a lot of red tape around opening a store. So does L.A., most of these big cities too. And they realize that it is making the industry less diverse. So they have said, you know, if you qualify, we're going to give you to the front of the, get you to the front of the line to get one of these licenses. But the problem there is, so what? Now you got a license. You still need $1 million and a place and about 30 full-time professionals to know what they're doing. It's not just about selling weed out of your trunk anymore. It's about running a business that's akin to like high-end mixed-use urban real estate development. It takes a lot of smart people to get these businesses open and run them.
866-733-6786 is the number to call. We're talking about the state of the cannabis industry in California. And Ellen in Berkeley, you're next. Welcome.
Hi. So I wonder if your guest thinks that the fact that California's marijuana tax revenue is affected by the fact that our law does not protect employment rights of marijuana users, unlike 16 other states that do. So workers can still be fired in our state for using marijuana, even off the job or for medical use. And it seems to me this must be affecting the customer base for the legal market here.
That's correct. One of the unsolved problems of cannabis legalization is employment rights. It's a big one nationally, and it's even affecting people who use CBD, the non-psychoactive molecule in cannabis that doesn't get you high. People are just using it for pain and anxiety and seizures. CBD can have trace amounts of THC in it, and if you take enough CBD, you can fail a drug test for THC. And then there's maybe 10 or 50,000 people who don't have any THC in their system that just took CBD. And if the drug tester is using an old method, that will register as THC, and then again, you can lose your job opportunity, you could lose your income, potentially parent rights. There's a lot of knock-on rights that come from these drug tests. And with regard to Prop 64 and employment rights, it was a bridge too far in 2016. But going forward in medical marijuana states and in newly legal recreational states, we're seeing more learnings from California with regard to your right to employment. And it's going to be something we're going to have to revisit in California and certainly nationally.
And again, is that something the legislature could do, like to, you know, around discrimination or however you want to describe it? Or would they have
to?
I don't think it was there anything in Prop 64 explicit that said,
you got it, and you got to keep drug testing? No, I'm sure the legislature could wake up tomorrow and go, THC coup drug testing in urine, which is what they do, is unscientific and invalid. You can't use it in California because if you smoke a joint today, you can fail a drug test 3 weeks from now. If you get drunk blotto today, you're going to pass that drug test tomorrow. We're losing out on a lot of qualified candidates, a lot of truckers, a lot of federal workers, a lot of teachers to responsible at-home cannabis use.
All right. Ellen, thanks very much for that call. And let's go now to Elizabeth in Los Angeles. Welcome.
Hi there. Hi. I'm wondering if David could talk a little bit about why, you know, we can't order legal weed through apps, through, you know, the Apple Store or Google Store. You know, it's a big block for the legal economy and a lot of kind of weird control over this market. And I'm curious about his perspective on that.
Yeah, thanks. Good question.
That's a great one. It's such a great intersection of tech, two California issues, right? Tech and cannabis. These tech platform providers like Apple and Google are providing these walled gardens for people to get apps in and download them. And the catch is that they're they're operating at the mercy of the federal government and federal regulators, where cannabis remains a Schedule One drug. And so we've seen Apple delete vaping apps from recently, and then certainly their terms of service preclude any app that facilitates the sale of an illegal drug. And that barrier right there is enough to make the app store be very shy about allowing apps that explicitly do that. The funny catch is that, like, underground sellers are using Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, not LinkedIn, but the other ones to advertise and sell. They're just doing it at a pace that's so heavy that the regulators at those companies can't stop them. So you might not be able to get an app to sell your cannabis in the app store, but people are using existing apps to do just that for good. For mostly for ill right now.
Yeah. Elizabeth, thanks very much for the call. What's going on with the Department of Justice, the U.S. federal Department of Justice, David? There were, I think initially when Jeff Sessions came in as the attorney general, there were sort of threats, but they seem to have receded. I mean, I haven't heard anything in California about any raids or anything like that.
We've seen U.S. attorneys in drug source states like Oregon and Colorado really bang the drum about how there's a lot of pot leaving their states and they want to see more done with regard to that. And they have a leg to stand on. In Oregon, an audit by the Secretary of State found that oversight in Oregon was very weak. No one was watching the watchers. And a lot of times the watchers weren't watching. And Oregon has a huge export problem. And those two are related. So that's where the U.S. attorneys have spoken up with regard to cannabis. At the bigger picture, the DOJ, I'm sure they're very busy with meth and opioids. Certainly that's what we hear from the DEA whenever we call them is like,
What about like Mexican drug cartels? I mean, I know they were pretty well entrenched in California before Prop 64. I mean, has that changed at all?
We see them continue to import across the border to get into the Midwest and the East. But the seizures are dropping to record low levels for cannabis. But these are drug trafficking organizations, so they're diversified.
So they're coming across the border. They're not growing in California, are you saying?
Less so. It's hard to find a farm on a piece of forest land that you can trace to El Chapo. What you do have is like a Mexican national out there camping for 6 months in the woods, tending to this cannabis garden. And he doesn't know who paid him, and he doesn't know who's picking it up. And there's plenty of people making inferences about that system. But if you look at who does the majority of gardening in California, it's often a lot of undocumented Latin Americans.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And David in San Francisco, you're next.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go right ahead.
So I have a point that ties into the point you guys made earlier about drug testing and work. And so since my wife gets works as a nurse, she no longer wants to smoke pot. So instead, we switched to LSD. And you ask, where do you get LSD? I get it on the dark web, And so I used to always buy pot in stores when it became, possible, because it was easy. But now with the taxes coming up and this issue of privacy, I'm thinking about switching my pot, to buy pot over the dark web. It's cheaper, it comes right to my house, and nobody really has to know. It's completely anonymous between me and the seller, and we both have a vested interest in keeping this completely anonymous versus giving over my driver's license to some store and their point of sale, technology.
David Downs? That's a good point about, handing over your ID, to get into a marijuana store. Like, what happens, if anything, to that, any information that they collect on you?
There's a new California law, as I recall, that says that it says something about the portability of that information and how you can opt out or you shouldn't be selling what the stores are collecting. No, here's what it was. The stores don't have to collect any information on you. They got to check your ID and let you in, similar to like a bar.
Check your age.
The issue was, we have 20 years of medical marijuana where you did a lot of intake before you were allowed into a store. You had to fill out a form and give them your medical info. And a lot of stores still have that legacy practice. And then new stores sometimes like the marketing. And so they want to know your email and your phone number so they can send you promotions. Most consumers, or a lot of consumers, are super sketched out these days about where their personal information's going and what's happening to it. And that's certainly a huge concern we've seen raised around the stores, especially if you're a visitor. Like, if you're from England and you're being carted at the front of a cannabis dispensary and you want to know what's happening to this information, because they can use that information to block you from coming in and out of the state, or the country rather. Although the reality is that the border customs is going to go through your phone and look for pot photos. They're not going to access some deep state web of everyone who's been into a dispensary.
So let's just say you're a dreamer. You know, you're here illegally. You came as a kid. You want to get some pot. I mean, is there an additional risk, you know, like a threat of deportation perhaps even? Is there any connection whatsoever with the federal government?
An immigration attorney will tell you that anybody whose immigration status isn't like 100% solid, like you're a citizen of this country, if you're interacting with a federally illegal controlled substance, it could have negative ramifications, and you want to like really speak with an immigration attorney about your level of involvement.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Brian in Oakland, welcome.
Hi, I run a or I'm involved in running a cannabis business, a retailer. And this is sort of a comment about the overregulation. It's interesting that you had the privacy concern right before this, because I can tell you as a business owner, we're pretty much required to collect all that information, if not purely because of the legal framework, because of the software platforms make us do it in terms of in order to be able to sell. And it's one of those situations where it feels like a level of overregulation that is designed to drive that very much supports the black market at the expense of the legal market.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to know what else is being done to fix that issue, because it's a very big issue for us.
Thanks, Brian.
I think we're going to be in a tough period where legal cannabis is going to be intensely scrutinized. We're ramping up the tracking and tracing of every gram grown of legal cannabis grown in California.
Ramping up, based on the regulations?
Yeah, most companies got a temporary license, and if they want an annual license, which is the final one, which you renew every year, you have to be on the state's track and trace system, which is administered by a private third party called Metric. So now the whole industry right now is in Metric classes, so they can log and track and trace every gram of cannabis that's sold in the state. I think medium to long term, I think we're going to see taxes come down and regulations come down as people sort of unclench about what we've legalized in California, and certainly regulatory parity is going to be needed. Again, we're tracking and tracing every gram of cannabis, or on track to, in this big state, and that seems disproportional to the harms of cannabis, considering other things that are out there that we're not particularly tracking and tracing.
Brian, thanks for the call. And is that information public, David?
The track and trace Metric data? You know, it's collected by the state, and there's this tension between what the state has to fork over to people like you and me when we ask for it because it's public information, and what they're allowed to mask because there's security risks or other types of risks. This played out with the locations of cultivation sites in Sacramento, where the city wanted that, and then the a newspaper published that, and that's kind of – that just puts like a bullseye in the back of those businesses, and so – That tension is going to continue to play out.
A few listener comments here. Tiffany asks, what are the guidelines or baselines for testing and labeling?
They're intense. Our cannabis was cleaner than our food for a good chunk of it. I mean, they test it for 62 pesticides. The label can't be off by more than 10%. So that 2.5 milligram THC mint, if it's 2.525, then it's over and they got to send it all back to the lab. We're testing for heavy metals now, pests and pathogens. It's a banner day for clean, tested, affordable cannabis in California, despite our tendency to look at the outliers, which is like the $80 eighths or some of these other issues.
And none of which, of course, applies to the black market.
Correct. And we know that a significant percentage of that supply is contaminated with aspergillus, mold, fungus, mildew, residual solvents, heavy metals. The pesticides we're finding in vape carts alone, oh my gosh, 5,000 times the legal allowable level of myclobutanol, which is a pesticide that when you burn it turns into hydrogen cyanide. You're allowed to spray it all over grapes and put it in a grape bottle, but it can't be on your cannabis, and they're really strict about that in California since July.
All right, back to the phones, and Alicia in Napa, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much, David. Great to hear you. You are so knowledgeable, and we're all so grateful for that. I just wanted to comment, as someone who's a firm believer in the need to maintain sort of a focus on the folks that are really committed to high quality in the cannabis space and what we consider to be the highest expression of cannabis, much like fine wine, are really the craft farmers and the craft manufacturers. And for all of the reasons that you all have been discussing, based on, you know, taxes and regulatory hurdles and, you know, poorly written ordinances in cities and counties, these craft farmers and craft manufacturers are being highly marginalized. And it's, for me, really important that we're all out there sort of beating the drum of consumer education and what that means to know your source and support regenerative, sun-grown farms and full spectrum, you know, whole plant intelligence products.
Yeah, Alicia, we're short on time, so I'm going to give David a chance to respond. And what does craft manufacturers mean when it comes to pot cultivation, David?
It's just like fine wine or food or designer sneakers. You're seeing people get premium prices for stuff that's, there's not a lot of it, and you got to be able to find it, and it hopefully is a lot better. And we're seeing that in California. We've gone from a $60 eighth in the black market to this price spectrum. We're seeing $25 half ounces, $50 ounces at the low end. That's like your $2 Chuck or your Pabst Blue Ribbon. At the high end, you're seeing these $80 eighths or $150 grams of hash. That's four times the price of gold for an extract. And it's very laborious and time-consuming, and it's actually very good. So we're going to continue to see more of that. There's going to be a lot of losers and some winners. But craft is here to stay. It's just a matter of how much of it's going to be there.
Alicia, thanks for the call. David, we're short on time, but looking into the crystal ball for 2020, what are you going to be looking for?
All right, so if we just had the terrible twos, we're ready for a three-nager, right? So a three-year-old's going to be a little bit more capable, maybe a few or less tantrums, but some bigger demands.
Bigger demands, and also what about the demand for the product?
I think that's not going anywhere, and it'll probably go up, yeah.
All right. David Downs, thank you so much for joining us this hour. He is the California Bureau Chief for Leafly.com, also the author of the Medical Marijuana Guidebook, America's first how-to guide for patients and caregivers. David, good to see you.
Thanks
for
Scott.
Coming in. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. Next hour, we're going to be talking about the history of gentrification and maybe the future as well.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.